And shared. Okay, guys. You guys want to help by sharing that on your Nostr profile. See if we can get people asking questions. I think that would make the conversation even more interesting. Okay, so.
Oh, can we see the questions in here then?
If you go to zap.stream, or I think if you have Amethyst, I think you can go to my profile and you can see where I'm live streaming and you can see the chat.
I'll check that out now.
Yeah. Okay, so for those just tuning in, hello. I have The Beav and Stella here. We're going to have an interesting conversation. Topics about the Bible, anarchy, and whatnot. So feel free to ask questions. I'll either answer them or at the end, or if it's has to do with the current conversation, I could ask it right away. So please ask. They've both gone down the rabbit hole of, well, I guess you could call it religion. Myself, I guess a quick introduction for those just tuning in. I'm in my religious journey. I'm very ignorant on a lot of things, and I hope Stella and the Beav will help correct me where I'm wrong. So for those who are in my journey right now, I used to be an atheist. I was raised Roman Catholic, turned atheist by high school, then became a deist around the end of my college years, believing that there's a higher power. Hold on, Stella got out, bring her back in. What happened here? Okay, there we go. So, and now I'm back into, I believe in God. So I believe there's a higher power, and I'm in this journey. So I think this conversation will be fruitful for both me and anyone else interested as well. So let's begin. Let's begin with Stella. Stella, can you give us a quick overview of what your beliefs are and where you stand right now in the topic of religion?
Okay, well, I was raised Roman Catholic, like a lot of people, and I kind of fell away from the church when I was a teenager and living on my own. And I came back into the church when I was 21, I think. And I was actually attending a Pentecostal church with my cousin. She started dragging me with her, and she was a woman's minister there. And then a half a year later, I met my husband, and he convinced me to go to church with him on Sunday, which turned out to be a Catholic church again. And at first I was just kind of sitting there, but then I really found my way back to the Catholic church. And it was very different coming back to it as an adult than just growing up in it. So. I've been attending church every Sunday at least since then, and I am the sextant at our church, and I even sing the choir, so I'm a real choir lady.
Cool. All right, and so right now, where do you stand in regards to the Bible and what us humans are supposed to do with it, or with God's teachings?
Well, the thing about, I think one of the reasons why I ended up coming back to the church is because just the teaching that I had gotten as a child about natural law, about the golden rule, these things that just stuck with me and helped me maneuver through the world and made the world make more sense to me. It gave me a framework to deal with my problems, to make decisions. And I think I just kept that. I think a lot of people have a huge benefit in their life of being raised with Christianity, and they don't really notice it, except that they're maybe more successful in life than a lot of other people, and less likely to be depressed, more likely to be able to have healthy relationships with other people. And I think that sort of stays with you your whole life. And I was away from the church for a while, and I met a lot of people who had never been in the church and who weren't exposed to any of that. And I could see how they were suffering under it. So I already was missing the material side of church, where it was just the scholastic, rigorous habit of analyzing scripture and studying it. Just this intellectual desire also just to read something philosophical and fundamental that you just don't really get outside of most religious communities. It's actually really, really difficult to even have philosophical discussions with most people because they are just completely in the day-to-day. They're not thinking about things beyond what they can see around them or what is happening in their life. And I think that that has really, that really made me more interested in religion again, just because I liked the thought of spending more time thinking about these things and delving into them a lot more deeply and understanding why these things turned out in my life to make so much sense. Like there was so much wisdom in them. And I thought, you know, this wisdom, it's coming through traditions, it's coming through the Bible. It's coming also, in my opinion, through the traditions of the active church. And I don't just mean the Catholic Church, I mean the whole Christian church. But the Catholic one, I think, in my opinion, is the oldest one. So I think it all goes back to them. And I really kept that. And I think one of the reasons I had left the church is because I saw a lot of religious people being extremely into the sort of charismatic side, where sort of, you know, Jesus, my boyfriend, and I, you know, they have chit chat with God all day. And I just didn't have that experience. So I'm like, I guess I'm just not a religious person. And it was very difficult for me to understand at the time that there's more than one way to be a Christian. Like, they're not all identical. They don't all have the same experiences. But you can have a really deep religious experience and not hear anything, not see any visions. But it's just internal. It's just like this feeling that you can feel like literally like wash over you. And I think recognizing this sort of religious diversity is something that actually helped me come back to the church. And I credit my cousin for that because she really explained that to me. She's like, I know there's always people who are loud in the church and talking about all this stuff. And then there's a lot of people who are just sitting there quietly who can't relate. But they are also there. They also belong to the church. Their faith is just as legitimate. Maybe they're just very academic and they really, you know, their religious experience is just reading, you know, Revelation. They love to read Revelations and study it, or reading through the old history, or studying about the traditions. And that's their way of connecting. And, you know, it's just a totally different mindset to think, okay, you always talk about men are from Mars, men are from Venus, but there's the same aspect in religion that you have people who are more academic, people who are more emotional, people who really feel it through art. Like they see beautiful artworks, they hear beautiful music, and it's a religious experience to them. Like, you know, it really touches their soul. And that's kind of where I got back into the church. And I really am grateful to the Pentecostals for teaching me about that. And I didn't expect it from them because I kind of associated them only with the sort of exuberant emotional outbursts kind of stuff. And actually, I was blessed to be at a Pentecostal church that had a really strong scholastic group. So a lot of really intense Bible study. And that was something I didn't really know from the Catholic Church, that, you know, you really read the Bible, like not just sit there in church and listen to it, but actually sit down with the book and just open the front page, and just read it through from the beginning to the end. And I did that twice there. And I think that actually really helped me get back into the church, was reading the actual Bible from the beginning to the end. And then read it again.
Well, that means you're pretty well-versed then in this. Okay, so Biv, if you would like to introduce yourself, please, and explain what your point of view is in regards to religion, the Bible, etc.
Sure. I'm the Biv. I'm fairly notorious on a lot of Noster because it's tiny and whatever. I am also notorious for saying that I have terrible opinions. So I'm going to preface pretty much everything I say with everything that I say is an opinion. There are some things that I will argue are more than opinion, but anything that I say, I am still learning a lot about this, because anyone who's actually serious about any faith in general, just not even Christianity, will tell you that it is a journey. And anyone who says it's not is probably lying to you, in my opinion. So I grew up in basically a non-denominational evangelical background, mostly influenced by various Baptist sects. my family, actually, my father's side of the family has a very, very, very long tradition of pretty hardcore Protestantism. Some of my family was over here in the U.S. before the 1500s, and they were related to, not exactly the same as, but related to the Puritans that you hear about in like the whole Thanksgiving thing. So pretty hardcore. They got chased around Europe a lot because they were inconvenient to people who wanted to cling to a lot of what I consider falsehoods of the Catholic Church. And I will be open and say that I'm very critical of the Catholic Church for a lot of things. I don't want it to filter down to individual Catholics. Like Stella, I have absolutely no, I don't doubt her faith. I don't doubt that she is a follower of Christ. Now, like she said, there are different ways to follow Christ, I think, because we're all individuals. And one of the things that I have become even more convinced over the last few years especially is that I believe that God wants to have a literal individual relationship with each and every human being. And nobody has the same relationship as anybody else. So that's part of the reason why I'm very individualist in a lot of my, I would, for lack of a better word, political beliefs, is because of the extreme emphasis on individual free will that I read in the Bible. As to what I can't really call myself anything specific right now, because I, like I said, I grew up Protestant, very Protestant. I went to a Lutheran grade school. I went to mostly Baptist influenced churches growing up. I actually attended a Catholic high school, so I'm very familiar with a lot of Catholicism. I know a lot of Catholics.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I've had a really, well, it's part of the weird fun part of growing up in New York City. Like, I was literally exposed to everything. And I have to say, as much as I don't like cities these days, that was actually, looking back at that, it was a pretty incredible time to be growing up in New York City in the 80s and 90s before it has ended up how it has now, and being able to explore the world just by literally taking a subway somewhere and walking into another part of the world was pretty incredible. So the last couple of years especially, I've been really trying to learn how to read the Bible. And this is controversial and non-controversial in a lot of ways, because as we heard from Stella, one of my bigger critiques of the Catholic Church is they don't really emphasize a personal responsibility to study God's word as much as I think is imperative. And that also actually translates over into some of the other major denominations too. So it's not just Catholics, but like, and there are certainly many Catholics who do actually have, they spend time studying the Bible and scriptures. But I've found just talking with people, especially over the last few years, most people don't actually know how to read the Bible. And like, there are people that literally have PhDs in discussing how we should read the Bible. So it's one of the things that differentiates, I think, Christianity in general from quite a lot of other religions, is that there has always been an emphasis, at least once you've gotten out of the Catholic sphere. Again, that's a critique of the church as a whole, not any individual. On really digging into the Bible and studying it. And I think that that's actually one of the best things that came out of Luther and the Reformation, was he brought the Bible to people's, like he started translating the Bible into German, which had never been done before because it was Latin. Unless you were educated and knew Latin, you couldn't read the Bible, basically. Unless you happened to be in one of the, you know, smaller Eastern Orthodox countries like Greece and, you know, places like that. They had their own different traditions that I'm learning about, because I actually don't know as much about the Orthodox traditions of stuff.
Actually, now that you mentioned that, yes, yeah. I think it would be very interesting to have a conversation with Ann Hearn. I interviewed him like a week or two ago.
Oh,
the
yeah.
podcast isn't out yet. He's on the he's an Orthodox Christian.
Yep.
So he put out the thesis of why the Orthodox ones are the more decentralized and anarchist type of version of Christianity out there. So I think talking about the branches of Christianity would be an interesting conversation to have with him if he can join us. Alcar, but sorry for interrupting you.
I very much agree. I think that would be, because I am actually working through a bunch of Orthodox literature now that I've never read before, and it's fascinating in a lot of ways. And I've learned a lot from different Orthodox people on how to actually read the Bible correctly. And by that I mean actually going back to the languages that it was written in and learning the context of the culture that the scriptures were written for. Because this is actually the end of my introduction, is that the Age of Enlightenment set up the move to postmodern thought. We are very far into the destruction of logical thought because of the postmodernists. That's a really complicated topic, and I'm going to leave it there because I could rant about that for hours, and we don't have the time for that.
You said about reading a Bible in context. I think that's actually one of the things I particularly liked about the Catholic Church, is that when I did read the Bible the second time, I read the American Catholic Bible, which had a lot of annotation about the history of what I was reading. So not other people's interpretations of it, but what was happening in the world at the time, or what is this a reference to in some other section? And it gave a lot of context. And I think I see a lot of people take things out of context and like try to turn it into a justification for something you want to do right now. And that's actually legitimate, because maybe it's applicable right now. Maybe in a different context, the modern context, it still makes sense. But I don't know if they are aware of the original context, if they know it and they're saying, okay, I'm bringing it to a new context, or if they just are just reading it alone and not really finding out any information around this section and reading it in complete isolation. Because there's actually a lot of like interlacing between the different sections. Like Jesus constantly... Yep. is referring back to things that were in the Old Testament. He's constantly also legitimizing his own role by saying, referencing things that the prophets in the Old Testament had expected of him, and showing that, yes, this is something that's going to happen. This is also going to be true. And sometimes he would do things that seem a bit odd when you just read the story. But if you know that he's fulfilling a prophecy, that this thing will happen and he will go to this place and say this thing. And then he goes there and he says it, and he says, and that is how it was written. And it happens over and over again. And if you just open it, like I heard a lot of people give the advice, start with John, just start, in the New Testament. And then they would open and start reading. And then these situations would come up in the Testament, and they were just confused. Like, why is he doing this? This is weird. Mm-hmm. What is he referring to? What is this supposed to be about? The story is just off. And it only makes sense if you know the original story that he's sort of recreating a scene from. or a prophecy that he's fulfilling. And I think that's actually something I didn't know the first time I read it. So a lot of the stuff he was saying, I just thought, well, he says weird things sometimes. I guess it's a religious thing. I don't have to know it. It's a theological mystery. And the second time around, it was like, oh, okay. I know what this is a reference to because I've read it now twice, and now I see it referred to twice, and now I have a little annotation that says, this number, this is the reference to that. And it's like, oh, okay. And a lot of the things that seem anachronistic or confusing in the Bible are because they have this sort of intertwining between the different sections, between the different episodes, different testaments. Also, there's the gospel where things are sometimes written in a different order, but it's actually the same scene. And that's also something that's very confusing. You think the same scene happened twice, but it's actually, you know, one time it happened before he did this, another time it happened after. But the order wasn't necessarily chosen merely to be chronological. You know, the gospel writers also chose the order of telling the stories in order to emphasize some particular point they were trying to make about the teaching and the life of Jesus. And so it's actually really interesting once you get into that sort of scholastic stuff. I'm not as far into it as Beef. I'm not even going to like try to compete with him on the whole I've read the Bible thing, because mostly I read it twice like 10 years ago. Since then I've read daily snippets or the Liturgy of the Hours, and I hear it read at Mass. Sometimes I read aloud at Mass. So I have a lot of exposure to the Bible, but I'm not studying it in that extent. I do a lot more singing, a lot of singing in Latin, a lot yeah. of attending the Mass. I think the thing I always missed from Protestantism is the Mass. I think that, you know, that they say, you know, it's an empty ritual, but to me, it's not empty. It's extremely meaningful. And the repetition, the whole Mass, like I read this book from Cardinal Rural about, I think it's Cardinal Rural, called The Mass.
I think it is. Yeah, I think yeah. you're right.
And it was so interesting because it was just showing all the symbolism that's in the Mass and how we repeat this over and over, because it's taught, the symbolism is important to remember. And he wanted us to do this in remembrance of him. And it's a way of making it more carnal. Not only scholastic, because my tendency would be just study books. You know, my handle on Noster, one of them is Leserin, which means the female reader. I've read so much.
Oh, true.
that I define myself basically as a bookworm yeah. in German. and my it would be my tendency just read stuff. And the Mass actually brings me out of my like max autism mode and puts me into the physical world again, in so to say, meat space, where Christ is very concrete, and he's you know, the Catholics, we believe he's physically in the tabernacle. And if we are at Mass, we are in his presence directly. I mean, if two or three people come together, he's already there. And if they do it mm-hmm. at a Mass, that like raises the height and the physical carnal nature of that interaction with him. And it's very intense. And I think that's something like I miss that when I go to Protestant churches, because I do sometimes go to Protestant churches. If they're having some special occasion, or if I'm visiting someone, they're going to church, or if I'm away from Catholic church on vacation and I can't get to it, I would go to a Protestant one. And I'm so appreciative of the Protestant church, also because they brought me back. Right? They're good at evangelization. They were out there knocking on doors, where we were all just hanging out in the Mass. They would really like go grab people and be like, Sunday you're coming to church, I'll come pick you up in my car, get you there. And I loved that enthusiasm for evangelicalism and for, you know, bringing more people into the fold, because it's so good for them. It's you're really helping them. And you're going, you know, you are risking something by doing that. You're risking a lot. And the more anti-religious the world becomes, the more you're risking. And they just keep knocking on the doors. are impervious. They just keep going, and I have total respect for that. And I think I've taken a lot of that with me. I'm more of this sort of I don't know how to say I say in English.
Outreach oriented.
Yeah, exactly. I'm more outreach oriented, missionary. That's the word. I'm much more missionary than most Catholics are, because a lot of Catholics are just really happy that they're there. They're like, whoever's not here, sorry to be them. But you really got to go out and find people and bring them in, because they may not, you know, it's you may it, the thing is that you may ask 20 people and 20 people say no, and then you think, oh, that was a waste of my time. But you don't know how often those 20 people have been asked by somebody else and by somebody else. And it could be the 20th person who asked that one person, where they say, okay, this time I'll come. And that was the case with me. So I take that totally seriously. It took a lot of asking to get me to go back to church. And then I've been there now for 25 years, right? Nonstop. And my cousin had already asked me at least 20 times. And she never gave up. She just asked the next day. And next time she saw me, hey, you ask again. Doesn't hurt. And I think I do that on Noster a lot. And I think people sometimes are kind of off put by that, because they're not used to Catholics acting like that. It doesn't seem like a natural Catholic thing to do, but I think it should be natural.
The orange pulling. Yeah, it sounds like a lot of the benefits of religion are obviously in community forming, right? And like I said, I've said it before, atheism, I don't think really exists, because if you take out God and religion, you've replaced that space with something else. Cause I think humans tend to be naturally spiritual animals. So, you fill it with the state, you fill it with the science TM, you know, there's always something that fill that void. Humans seem to need this. So I think it's best to fill it with religion, you know, something that's standed the test of time, withstood the test of time. And well, there's multiple ways to take this conversation. I know Stella is you have a limited time, so okay. So one question I had, actually, we'll leave that for another time. But one of the things that the Beef said is that there's a right way to read the Bible. If I understood that correctly, like to me, that's as a person who's new to this, like that sounds interesting. Like there is a way, like it's a book, and I think it can be interpreted in a lot of ways. But I we'll get into that question if we have more time. I think the more interesting conversation, even for the listeners, would be to focus on, what started this this whole conversation was a post that Lesrin did in Auster, made in Auster. She wrote, anarchists know that they can destroy civilization and set the world on fire and then create order out of chaos, just like God did. That's what, when I saw that, I'm like, oh, this is interesting. And then going down that conversation, I saw the beef starting to reply back. So I'd like to focus on that. I think it'd be like a very interesting thing, because I personally guess you could say I identify as an agorist, you know, I guess applied anarcho-capitalism, and also acknowledging there's limitations to the theory behind anarcho-capitalism. But I think that's where we should take this. Basically, Beav, if correct me if I'm wrong, you argued that the Bible is actually like an anarchist book in a way, or like God's teachings are like anarchist, because I guess because it goes down to the individual level. Am I correct on this, or what's your view on it?
Technically, no, because anarchist, the word literally means no king, anarchos. It's a Greek word. A Christian literally believes that Jesus is king, so it's not. Basically, it means that there are no human kings but Jesus, and that we owe no allegiance, nor should we, in my opinion, make oaths or support other kings other than Jesus, and that other kings or rulers of any sort, basically, with one possible exception, that being your religious leader. Most likely like a parish priest in the case of Catholic, or just a regular priest in the Orthodox, or your pastor of whatever sort in a Protestant church. Because that is the biblical model. In the Bible, in the Old Testament, if you look at, especially in Samuel, the book of Samuel, there's two of them technically. But the people known collectively as Israel at the time decided that they wanted a human king. God was like, are you stupid? Because I'm literally here ruling as your king. Because that's one of the things a lot of people miss from the context of that story, is that God was literally dwelling physically in the tabernacle, the tent that he set aside as his home. He was literally there as a ruler. Like, he was literally sitting on the throne. The Ark of the Covenant was his footstool. That's how it's described in the Old Testament. And also even in the revelation of John, like, he's literally sitting on a throne with the Ark of the Covenant, which was a symbol of the covenant between God and the nation of Israel, because God set Israel apart as his portion of the nations of earth after the kerfuffle at the Tower of Babel. There's a lot more to that, but that's as condensed as I can get that. But the Israelites wanted a human king because they saw all of the other nations had a human king. And I don't know how they ignored all the bad stuff that came along with that, but they were like, well, we want a king. So their method of choosing a king was like, that dude over there, he's tall and good looking. Well, let's make him king. And it's literally just that vapid and stupid.
It hasn't changed.
Right.
It hasn't changed since then. That's politics, Gavin, today, too.
Gavin Newsom polls well with people because he has fantastic hair.
And I'm not even joking about it.
I'm not denying that.
He's getting my vote. That's definitely it.
But, like, that's how they decided that they wanted a king, and God warned them that if you do this, then your king is going to take too much in taxes, pull your sons away for war, take your daughters for his own purposes, you know, exploit you. And the rest of the Old Testament is the story of how everything that God said would happen with a human king happened, because, you know, he's omniscient and he knows what will happen when people make certain decisions. So if you look at the context of that, the whole context of that, I believe that humans were designed to have a direct relationship with God, meaning that we are his sons and daughters. So if God is the king of everything, we are literally royalty. And that means that you have rights and responsibilities being the literal sons and daughters of God. Your right is to subdue the earth. You have the right to basically own property. You have the right to do with it as you will, as long as you don't step on the rights of the other royalty, that literally being every other human on the planet. As long as you're living in accordance with how God wants you to live, you're literally free to do anything you want, or should be. So I pull from, especially from that story, and also even just looking at how God interacts with people through the whole story of the Bible from Genesis to Revelation, he is the one that set the respect for human free will, because he created us, because he wanted us to be literally his image, his representation of his creative powers, of all of his potentialities, of all of the infinity, beyond infinity, that he is here on this planet, whether you believe it's a ball or a flat earth or whatever. I like teasing the flat earthers, but they actually do make some points that I honestly can't scientifically, you know, figure out. So like I'm open to that, but that's a whole other thing. But God made us to be sovereigns of our own families, basically. He created us. He created the world, and he called it good. And that word specifically means a whole lot in Hebrew, because it's different from the words that are used to describe God, who is basically complete or perfection. And the difference between those words implies that the mandate that God gave us in Genesis to be fruitful and multiply, to subdue the earth and to make it into a paradise, because that was the original job of humans, is to literally turn this good place into something perfect, to co-create with God, to turn the entire world into a beautiful garden filled with good things to eat and beautiful flowers and wonderful things to smell and see and interact with. That is what I believe the purpose of humans is. And it would take too long to get into why we aren't at that place right now, but that's the context that I start with when I read the Bible.
And I want to hear Stella's opinion on that. But yeah, I do remember reading that portion of the Old Testament, you know, when the people of God, the Israelis, are asking God for a king, and God saying, like, this is why it's a bad idea. And then I was like, oh my God, God is so based. You know what I mean?
So, yes.
So, like, obviously I'm biased towards to that he was, you know, human government is bad. Quick question, what would you call that? So it's not anarchy for reasons you just explained. So yep. What's the name of basically just Christians or
Christians are their own thing.
I would say that it's a biblically based Christ follower is someone who believes that. Like I don't have a specific term for it, because it's not like there isn't one way to be that. Because again, we're all individuals and we all have our very specific purposes that we have been created for. Mm-hmm. We're all supposed to be a part of God's plan to make paradise here, which is one of the biggest reasons why I think Protestantism has in general lost the plot, especially evangelicalism, is because they're always worried about like the rapture and getting to heaven and all this stuff, when they're completely ignoring the fact that we're literally supposed to stick around here and make this place better, but not like the Christian nationalists who literally want to vote people into office and use government to force all the heathens to be good Christian people. That doesn't work. That's never how God has functioned ever in the entirety of existence. And thinking like that just shows how deep and pernicious the lies of the state and government and control, and a lot of it comes down to the original sin of pride applied to trying to control people through extrapolated power. And that's all political power is extrapolated and wrested from the individual. And the only thing that has ever mattered, that's not technically correct. I was going to say the only thing that ever mattered is the individual to God, but that's not true, because there are groups. Like God even talks about the nations and different groups of people, but individual will, individual relationship with God has always been the forefront. God chose specific people in history to change the entire flow of history. Like there are people that we read, like Moses and, you know, King David and Jesus. Like there are humans that have had an outsized influence. But the takeaway from reading the Bible is that every single decision that you make matters. Nothing you do, think, say, eat, buy doesn't matter. The problem with that is too heavy a responsibility for almost everybody, unless you are operating under the grace of forgiveness for making mistakes, because we are human and we do make mistakes. But and that's the gospel. That is the good news, that we don't have to live with that burden because God solved that through Jesus.
All right.
We don't have to, we don't have to freak out about it. Like, okay, I screwed up. Now what? Like, it's not the end of the world. It's not the end of my life. I can go on because God has already solved the problem of that, as long as you have a relationship with Him. He's forgiving. He's loving. He wants to have that relationship with you. And that's one thing. That's what I think is so unique about Christianity in general, is that if you look at every other religion or mythology, none of that, there is nothing like that in anything else. It's entirely unique. And that's,
I've been thinking about that, about Christianity this week. I mean, this, you know, you were saying, Fernando, about atheists substituting religion with other things. And of course, now they're all really hyped up on this whole singularity thing coming, where AI becomes their personal God, and they can upload their consciousness into the metaverse or whatever. And I was thinking about how one of the few religions that seems to be able to deal with all sorts of crazy things that go on Earth, and all the disruption and the technical advancements and everything, is Christianity. And it has such a staying power, despite the fact that innovation, technological innovation, societal innovation, innovation in the way we interact with our environment, space exploration, you know, contemplating aliens, that kind of thing. It's been able to just sort of absorb all of that and just keep going. And I was thinking about what that is. And I think it's because, here we get back to your question, Christianity is primarily concerned with the soul, with the afterlife, with the time outside of time, with dimensions we can't experience in human form, and it's less obsessed with, and here's where I disagree with you fundamentally, I think it's less obsessed with the day-to-day, you know, what did I have for lunch and that kind of thing, and it, those things can change, and it just keeps going because it was never about those things. At the same time, I agree with him that as pilgrims, because all Christians, the Catholic view is that we're all pilgrims, we're all progressing towards eternity spent at the right hand of God, right? And so we're all just pilgrims on this journey to heaven. And on our way, we're supposed to follow the Boy Scout rule of leaving the things we interact on the way better than they were, if we can, right? So we're not supposed to just ignore the things going on around us. And this is where I agree with him about some of the evangelicals lately, is that we're not just supposed to sit around and wait for the rapture. That's that's not what we're supposed to do. First of all, it's kind of it kind of goes against what he said specifically, that he will not return when we are waiting for him. He will catch us unawares, off guard. So we should always be ready, because we don't know when it's going to happen. And as soon as you get, like, there's in Africa, this guy who got everyone, like, building another ark. I don't know if you guys thought that was a joke, but it turns out it was really was some guy building an ark, and everyone was trying to get into the ark because the flood was going to come again. And then so this is the return of Jesus and all this kind of thing. And I just thought, you know, this is exactly the sort of thing Jesus was warning against. This is not the mentality Christians are supposed to have. They're supposed to keep going about their day, every day, as if he's going to show up that day. And as if they're going to die on earth before he shows up. And that means they have to always care about the people around them. They have to follow the golden rule in their daily life. They have to try to make sound decisions. They have to, here also, I think it's important that we're more integrated into our communities and that we do have a positive effect on them. I don't really like the sort of, okay, politically, I'm very much like a sort of classical liberal, just gone completely out of style. Nobody wants to be liberal anymore because the word is already so tainted with, you know, libertines and that kind of thing. But I've done a lot of typical Catholic study of ancient Greek and Roman history, the Greek philosophy. And I really understand where they're coming from with a lot of stuff. Also, their ideas with the natural law that really makes sense to me. That I think people already touched on this, that humans have, in my opinion, rights that they're born with. I think the Constitution, inalienable rights, right? That you can't take away, you can only infringe upon. And I think that the idea that America had, which at the time almost seemed like anarchy, was the idea that the Constitution is not there to define the rights that the state has, but it's there to define the rights that the state, especially the Bill of Rights, the state cannot infringe upon because they do not belong to the state. They belong to the individual. And I think this is a strong meme in America because of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights, and some of the articles. They really focus on this individual right, and I'm very much for that. I'm not an anarchist, and here's the difference between being an anarchist. Not because I think we need to have a government. I don't need that. My life would be fine without the government, because I'm in an area where there's the community is very tight, where the church is very strong. So we have like a kind of a second layer of organization, where if the state of Bavaria or the German government collapsed, you know, nobody here would go hungry. Nobody here would freeze in winter. It would still be pretty okay. Most people would be trying to probably move here from everywhere else. So I don't have this sort of need to cling to the state for my own sake. But I do think that people who just want to, who are hoping that the state gets overthrown, underestimate the amount of grief that would result from that and suffering on the human level. I mean, they may say, you know, you don't get an omelet without breaking some eggs, but I care about the eggs too. I especially see now with the older populations that we have, I don't know how resilient all of those old people would be. And I feel like the state is going to slowly decay and grind down over time on its own, just under the weight of its own inefficiency. And it's going to, there's something new that's going to be coming up. But I don't really want it to end abruptly because I feel like humanity can't evolve fast enough or adapt fast enough to deal with that sort of drop off. And I think people underestimate how horrible would that be. Like the electricity would stop. And people would say, you know, it's not a big deal. I'll just make a warm fire and roast some bratwurst and then that's okay. I don't need the electricity. But they don't understand how many people's lives depend on electricity being up. It would just be millions of people being dead within a week, right? You know, it's just, it's unfathomable for me. Like, I don't think people realize how brittle human existence has become and how much we are reliant upon modern technology, upon systems of government also that just do things like manage the electricity grid. The private sector can do that. it's taking over the electrical grid more and more. More and more people have their own personal grids on their houses. There's more and more people who are off the grid entirely. But that all takes time. Like, it's very hard to just flip a switch, turn all electricity off that the government produces, and everything's happy. I don't think that's the way things work. Just like, I don't think closing down all the government hospitals would make everyone healthier. Over time, maybe, but not on that day. And I just feel too much responsibility for the people around me to wish that upon them. And I also don't see the necessity of it, because I think that letting things sort of slowly decline gives us time to build up an alternative. It takes a lot of time. I mean, I've been in a lot of organizations, you know, we have our own project at Good Citadel, and it's taken us 2 years to even really figure out what exactly we want to build, what exactly we want to do, what, and we're still discussing it. You know, it takes a long time for new institutions and substitutes to form. And I think people underestimate that, but I've been in so many volunteer organizations. I've worked at different companies. And I've seen how long it takes and how hard it is. And that's probably the reason why I'm not an anarchist, is because I don't see anarchy as a good unto itself. Rather, I see I want the well-being of the individuals to be at the forefront, and I'm willing to entertain the idea that anarchy could be a way to raise the well-being of the individual on the immediate. But I don't think it's necessarily the only way, and I don't think every other way is illegitimate. I'm more outcome oriented, but I'm not personally invested in the state in the sense that, like me was saying, the Christian nationalists, they want to overtake the state politically and decide what it does. I'm more ambivalent. I want a state that is well run, that is very subsidiarity respecting, so devolving power down to the lowest possible position. In this case, it'd be the head of house, right? Almost everything would be the head of house, because almost no decisions actually need to be taken outside of the home. That's something I very, very just feel strongly about. And as soon as you're outside the home, the next level up for me is the church. That's where the next decision should be made, and also the local community. So I'm with the anarchists on the whole devolvement of power thing, and I don't necessarily like hang on national government as a institution. I feel like my life would be worse if they didn't exist. As long as there was some other system that was also working to, you know, keep people alive who need medical assistance, and make it possible to have a bridge over a large river and not have it collapse. You know, but that system is going to be more complex than government, much more, probably less centralized. But just decentralized does not mean, as we've seen in Nostra, does not mean less complex. It can actually mean much more complex, because you have to pull the strings constantly to get it all working. I mean, with automation, AI nowadays, you can even entertain these ideas, right? Like Nostra before AI wasn't really possible, right?
Yeah. Because I think that, yeah, decentralization is definitely more chaotic, but I think it responds faster and has better outcomes in the long run. But I think here we can agree that, tell me, correct me if I'm wrong, Beeb, I think most serious or well-read anarchists agree that if we have anarchy tomorrow, that would be a net negative to the world right away. It would be pure chaos. Yes. And that it's logical that people need education, and it has to be a more slower transition, pushing towards decentralization like we're doing on Nostr, how Bitcoiners are doing. There's going to be a lot of hiccups in the road, but I think that's the path. And I think anarchy, I think the way I see it is that we need that is extreme, in this case, anarchy, that pushes for less and less government, because we've all seen with the pandemic and stuff, people tend to be compliant, you know? So I think you do need a group that's constantly screaming, in this case, the I would say ANCAPs, at least, or agorists, that we got to take away government, because yes, it's probably going to be impossible. I don't think there's a way to completely eliminate government off the face of the earth. I just don't. But I think you need this extreme. So if we fall short, you know, we still have a place or a world or a geographical area where there isn't as much government. You know what I mean? I think that's how I that's how I see the dynamics between in dynamics of humanity in long term, because I think ethically, morally, anarchism to me makes sense. You know what I mean? It's all about the individual. It's about not infringing on other people's property, you know, their life. And it just makes moral sense to me, as opposed to, like, you know, obviously socialism, Marxism, and all that stuff, right? Deciding for others what's best. Like, who are you? Like, this elected group of people or self-elected people, like, who are you to decide what's better, what to do with my time or money, which is basically the same thing in a way. So getting that aside, do we agree on that part, though? Like, anarchy is bad if it happens tomorrow, but perhaps is something good long-term, or is there, like, any objection to that?
No, I actually agree with that, because forcing people into chaos is actually, I think, a violation of their sovereignty. And also, it's hard for people in general to cope with extreme changes very outside of their expectation. And I think that it is a natural human tendency to expect a set of behaviors that, in even across religious or cultural boundaries, there is an expectation of this is what is normal behavior. And, like, not that all of those things agree, obviously, because that's one of the differentiators between cultures and religions, is those expectations of behavior. But if you suddenly pull the rug out from, to use a very popular Noster term, you know, if you rug an entire population, that is hurting them. And I don't think that's right. My biggest contentions with government in general are the tendency towards control. And they want to control more and more and more, even though they aren't capable of it, because, you know, psychopaths love more power and they have a very high opinion of themselves and they can't see that they're not actually making good decisions that are going to lead to their own downfall, like Stella said. But I think that the anarchists in general, that, like, the anarchists that I know literally just want to be left alone on their own property. They want to grow their own food. They want to trade food and goods with people without having to be taxed to death. They don't want to have to, a lot of them don't want to have to engage in fiat money, but they have to pay property taxes, which are insidious, because you're literally changing ownership into rent. You know, income taxes. I know people that live with very little money, like very little fiat money. But the tax man is always going to come at some point, and you have to be ready to deal with that in a bunch of different ways, either violently or not, because the assumption is that you have to pay taxes. And my contention is that taxation in general is not appropriate, especially looking at what our taxes are going to. In, you know, at least in the West, like, I don't feel like funding pedophile cannibals. I don't. And anybody who thinks that anything other than that is going on is really naive. And that's why I don't want to pay taxes.
That was, like, interesting with the whole Epstein thing, is that it was, like, almost anticlimactic, because we all thought they were pedophile cannibals, and then it was like, here are the emails that are talking about how they are pedophile cannibals,
right?
And it's, well, like, we all knew. we smelled it.
And that leads to something else. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Stella, in the post you had in the conversation that was ongoing. So obviously the state is organized violence, a monopoly on violence. And I guess a lot of way that anarchists see it is you have to organize yourself, create parallel economies, be able to counteract that. Obviously, as an individual, you're defenseless. As an organized group, you stand a better chance. Now, anarchists say like anarchy is it's rules. It's you know, it's no rulers. There's rules, but there's just no rulers. But I think I saw Stella. You said like when people organize, they eventually can become the state. You know what I mean? If they can make a militia army and stuff like that, they eventually end up becoming the state. Or in this case, an anarchist point of view, they become what they swore to destroy or to avoid and stuff alike. So I'd like to hear your opinion on that. Well, first of all, Stella, if you could, if you want to develop that a bit more further. But before that, quick question for you, Stella. Like in your, you said you live in a community where the church is strong, and it's basically, I guess, like a support group. Like, I'm guessing there's a set of rules in this community, right? Like, what happens if you break it? Or can you I'm guessing you can voluntarily get up and move, right? If it comes to that, if you don't like what the church, local church is becoming or the community is becoming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can move. You can leave. Okay.
Are there any expected rules? I mean, just expected behaviors. Can you speak out against if the church does something like, I don't know, raising money for a cause that you don't believe is just or ethical? I don't know. It's just a random thing. Can you protest against what the church is doing locally, or is there
actually, even a reason? Yeah, that's actually easier here, because there are so many people who are active in the church who have an opinion about what the church is currently doing, and they don't always agree, and they publicly fight about it. So, you know, you sometimes get like two teams for every topic. You know, these are the people who are for it. I mean, it's stuff like, you know, whether or not you should put the Catholic kindergarten next to where the priest lives, because then he can't have his nap because the kids are loud in the garden. And oh my gosh, then this other side is like, oh my gosh, it's such a horrible thing to say. It is, you know, these are little kids. He should be happy there's so many little kids next door. But also he's a really old guy. He needs his nap. And I mean, that sounds really trivial, but entire churches fall apart over really trivial things like that. And, you know, it turns into like a border war, you know, these people sit on this side of the church and these people sit on that side of the church. And I think it's actually quite adversarial sometimes in our community between different factions of the church. Like I'm probably more in the sort of liberal faction. You know, it's funny because I'm an Austrian. I'm sometimes seen as being like super ultra conservative. And I am on some very particular questions. But and only because I see it in the Bible as unequivocally clear that it's meant to be that way. And so I'm not willing to discuss it. And that makes me sound really conservative. But it's just because I think the Bible in this case is like, it's just this way. Don't be worried about it. Focus on heaven. It's just the way it is down here. You'll get over it. You'll get past it.
I'm curious, like what happens after those discussions and like supposed divisions about certain topics? Like people still go to the same church?
People sometimes leave the church. Leave the church. Some people leave the town. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, people leave the town over things like that. Yeah. Wow. Because they don't agree with their, I mean, it was also, you know, during COVID we were still having masses. I mean, a lot of places they stopped having masses because, you know, they had trouble having people sit. And we put a lot of effort into following the rules so that people could still come to mass. And we didn't bother people who weren't making a mask, which we probably, you know, from the law, we were supposed to say something. But instead, we just held masses outdoors as much as possible. And we did a lot of this sort of thing. And there were a lot of people who said that we were being really irresponsible. And that it's shameful that Christians are so irresponsible about the well-being of their neighbors.
Did the state come knocking to punish you for that? No?
No. Nobody hears tattletales.
Oh,
I do have to say, even when they fight internally, there's not a lot of tattletaling unless you really have done something really egregious, you know, like murder someone or molest somebody.
It's family business. You don't talk about family business. It's
the infight. And it does feel like a big family. And like in a family, you have people who become like the black sheep and no longer invited. Yeah. Not that they're not invited to church, but like, you know,
But I think what you're describing is exactly how I think most anarchists see it. Like, you do have a hierarchy, you do have institutions in a supposed anarchic region, just like the church, you know, but you have the freedom to leave, you know, no one's gonna force you to stay or threaten you to die or to kill you or something like that. I think that's how,
yeah,
the outcome would be in theory. I think the question then becomes
that, but the problem with that idea is there's always, anarchy assumes there's always some place for you to go, right? And there isn't in reality. Right now, you can leave this town and go someplace else because other places are still nice. But what if we get to a point where anarchy really starts to happen and this is one of the few places that you can live safely? I mean, we had this recently when the border was open really wide and people were flooding over the border. There were parts of other cities where people stopped leaving the house because it got so bad. And they would show up in our town on the weekend. Like, all of a sudden, the playgrounds were full. The soccer field was full of people. We didn't know where all these people were coming from. We realized they're escaping, right? They're escaping from these other places. Just like during the lockdown. During the lockdown in the cities, our villages were all overrun with people from the cities hiding from the people, the police in the city. And, you know, anarchy would assume if you don't like it here, you can leave. But that's actually exile. And exile is also a form of violence, really. It's not violence. It's not overt. But if you say, okay, this is the way it's going to be. If you don't like it, you can leave. And leaving might cause the person to die. Then you're basically forcing them to leave. Or you're forcing them to do what you want. Because the alternative is they have to leave. And if they leave, they die. Which means you're giving them a death sentence if they don't do what you say. And I think that's one of the things where I think anarchy is sometimes very philosophical and theoretical, but in reality, staying in the community can sometimes be the only way you can ever. And saying people, you could always leave. It sounds really fair, but I think fair would be to really give more room to minority views. So this is where the liberal, classical liberal comes in. This gives more room to minority views, to allow them to voice their opinions, to protect minorities, even if they are really a problem for the rest of the community. I feel like the rest of the community should just have to sort of suffer a bit and deal with their presence, because I think forcing someone to leave is such a horrible thing that I wouldn't really want that to be the default. I wouldn't want that to be, maybe it's my inner mom coming out, but it's like, can't we all get along? We can't all get along, which means there has to be a form of mediation. And if a mediation doesn't work, I don't think the only way to end the discussion should be, okay, then you have to go. But if that's not the only way you end the discussion that is intractable, then that means other people have to agree to do stuff they don't want to do. And that's where anarchy would say no. If keeping that person around means that we all have to start paying a fee for something, right? Because this person is raising some sort of cost that falls on all of us. And now we all have to chip in to cover that. And then we start passing the hat around. Then it's the question of who's not willing to put money in the hat, right? So you've taken this, forced this one person out, and you've taken that pain and you spread it over the whole group. And that's the difference between me and an anarchist. The anarchist would say, you should never split it on the group. That person should just have to go. And I would say, no, it would depend on the case, in my opinion. Yeah. Like, there are cases I think, no, I think we should just have to deal with him being around and we should just cough up the cash.
So I think
that's where the fundamental difference.
I want Beef to respond, but real quick, I want to chime in. I think perhaps that's from the basis of how I think maybe you're taking like how we live right now and extrapolating into how an anarchic world would look like. Because in a world where like we bring back community, like you mentioned, like the church, and we bring back family values, that person who supposedly will become a burden on society would actually perhaps have a family member to take that burden. You know, I mean, people who actually love this person and care about them. So it doesn't necessarily have to be extrapolated to the entire, like, say, community. You know what I mean? It can if everyone agrees, right? And I think with Bitcoin as well, like imagine every single individual having a hard money, gold, silver as well, like having a money that doesn't devalue over time, housing costs are down. I think the barrier to actually move if you disagree with something wouldn't be a death sentence. And I do agree with you. Like what you're saying, that it would be a death sentence back then, I think that's true. That holds true. I'm talking about like medieval times. I think ANCAPistan is possible only in modern times, you know, because of technology, because of things. Back then, yes, like if it were like a small tribe in the middle of the Amazon, yeah, you go out there, you're dead. But nowadays, it's, and if with Bitcoin as like a hard asset people, or money people can hold, moving is perhaps cheaper, safer, obviously, you know, because of modernization. But that's just my point of view. Anyways, well, Beav, do you want to say something?
I have to go. I don't want to jump out of the conversation, but I got to go now.
No. Okay, so yeah, I guess
you got to go.
Guys,
take care of your family.
Yeah.
I have to go for dinner.
Yes. Sorry about that, Sally. Look, okay, so I guess we can do a part two of this. So I'll let Beav just respond to this, and then we'll end it. Stella, I guess you can rewatch mm-hmm. later if you want to see what Beav responded to. But I think we'll organize a part two.
Okay. Part two.
You guys okay with that?
Sounds good. All right. Thank you for inviting me.
No, thank you, Stella, for coming on. All right, Beav. So do you have something to add or say to what Stella mentioned?
I actually agree with her.
Oh, I can't really hear you.
Oh, sorry. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, there we go.
Okay. Sorry about that. I actually agree with almost everything she says. I don't want people to be ostracized for a lot of different things, but ostracization and shunning is a powerful tool that has been employed by every society to try to keep a median in a lot of ways and to honestly root out extremes that are harmful to what is nominally acceptable. And that as a tool, it can be used correctly or incorrectly. We saw it being used incorrectly during the whole COVID thing, in my opinion. Although, you know, a lot of people were on the side that it was the correct thing to do. You know, like you shouldn't have anything to do with relatives who are unvaccinated, or, you know, you're horribly irresponsible for going to church or anything like that. But like, I think that the world would probably be in a way more peaceful if people were actually less tolerant, because we do, like you are saying, we do have much more freedom of movement. We do have the ability to live in places that we couldn't necessarily have gotten to without the technological abilities that we do have now in transportation and communication. And you're right about that. Like ANCAPistan really couldn't have existed without much more violence being done. More than 50, 60, 70 years, maybe a century ago. But we do have examples in fairly recent history of people that have survived in places in groups that they came together and they overcame adversity. And I mostly just don't want government to interfere with that. And that's, we're seeing like in the EU with the digital ID that they're pushing, and Australia's already passed the law supposedly to protect kids that you can't be on social media. If you're under 16, they have the digital ID requirements for social media now. It's so transparent that it's not about the kids. That's literally just a control measure. It's laughable, but that's the pretext that they're using. I have no use for that kind of pretext or lying or just outright deception from any government. You know, the United States is rushing headlong into installing digital ID for voting, which is going to be used to track everything because Peter Thiel has been raising J.D. Vance up to the position that he's in. They've been buddies forever. So you have Palantir literally trying to collate all of the information that all of the really nasty parts of the government have on the citizens of our own people that they shouldn't have. Like they shouldn't have any of that information at all, period. And then they're going to try to bring it all together. And the only thing that they're going to do with that is use it to control people. And yep. I don't want that, period, point blank. I just don't want that. Like, and I don't want to pay for them building the digital gulag to put me in because I am a dissident and I will not comply at all, period.
And I think that's a worse being ostracized will be much worse, I think, if the government is the one in charge of that instead of the communities. No, it's going to be a much worse.
Well, yeah,
they can literally kill you by you not being able to work, buy things.
Yep.
So again,
well,
I guess
have you seen what they've been doing? Like, have you seen the people that don't exist in China? Like, they literally can't do anything. Well, it's like with the social credit score. Like, if your social credit score falls too low, you can't work, you can't buy, you can't send money, you can't, you literally can't do anything except starve to death on the streets.
I don't know how much that is true, because I've seen comments against that. That's like this, maybe going too far, but I believe it could be true, honestly. I wouldn't be surprised if it is, but.
Yeah. I think even if it isn't true, the potential exists. And like I forget who said it, like this, the purpose of the system is what it does, not what it is stated to do. So why are people accepting the potentiality of building systems that can literally it's like the whole left and right thing, you know, red versus blue. It's just posturing to maneuver us to a solution that they've already prepared that is worse for us than anything we can imagine. And I'm just not cool with that.
Totally agree.
I agree with Stella that local community is necessary. But that's the one thing that I don't think she understands is that most anarchists, especially the ones that I know, the ones that I'm familiar with, they're more communal than people who aren't. Like, you know, the anarchists are actually the ones, forming parallel economies. And you literally can't do that unless you're talking to people, unless you're trading goods, unless you're buying and selling stuff outside of the fiat monetary system. Like, you literally can't do that. You can't survive on your own and be an anarchist. You just can't. That's the contradiction that I don't think a lot of people understand. Like, yes, anarchy has been intentionally associated with violent political movements like the Troubles in Ireland. Obviously, that was not ideal. You know, the whole like the violent punk anarchist thing in the late 70s and early 80s. Again, not ideal, but also not the same thing as modern anarchists who literally just want to be left alone to raise their kids, to, you know, eat what they want to eat, to, you know, participate as much or as little in the medical stuff, you know, as they want, to be able to buy and trade without being taxed to death. Like, none of that involves violence, except the government gets involved.
Yeah, because a lot of people don't know the history of anarchy. Like, the first anarchists were actually anarcho-communists, right? So, and they were violent. They were violent.
Yes,
and
they absolutely were.
But it evolved. It's like anarcho-capitalism is much newer, actually, than anarcho-communism. But a lot of people stayed with that, I guess, bad taste, you know? So, and then you see the Antifa people giving, again, anarchists a bad name, right? There they are.
Well, that's
riding
not
on the streets.
Anarchy, though. Because they're more collectivist and they're more in lockstep with each other, and they're literally out there advocating for violence against other people, which is completely against any general modern interpretation of anarchy, where like you cannot coerce people into doing something they don't want to do. Like that, like that's just the long and short of it. If there is coercion, A, it means your ideas suck. Like if you have to coerce people into doing something, you're either not expressing yourself correctly, or there probably is a better way. And if you can't think of it, that's a you limitation, not a them problem.
Yeah.
And well,
no, I totally agree with that. I do think like one of Estella's arguments that she put in the post, again, Estella, you're hearing this, so forgive me if I'm misrepresenting what you said, but yeah, like, you know, if anarchy eventually does come and there's a region, it won't be like the whole world becomes anarchy, right? There'll always be states around it. If Ancapistan were to come to fruition, and you didn't have like an organized army, you need to defend yourself. And I think this is one of the parts, like, I think it's actually a valid point, right? Naturally, this region, people associating would have to create a defense force of some kind to be able to protect themselves against, you know, the state that surrounds them.
It's
a fair assumption to say that what would stop these people eventually organizing an army and then organizing a state and becoming a state themselves, you know, in time, especially becoming successful, you know what I mean? Become prosperous and rich, have, like power.
We have historical analogs to that. Like if you look at the constitutions of a majority of the constitutions of the original 13 states that ratified the U.S. Constitution, if you look at the state constitutions, they had requirements for any resident or any citizen, any male citizen between usually like 18 and 35-ish generally, had to be armed, trained, and prepared to defend the state from the federal government or outside threats. Like a militia is literally an organized, decentralized defense capability. That was the norm for over 100 years for the United States. And we were, like, in specifically in the United States, we were warned that standing armies lead to taxation, leads to wars, and we ignored that, and we have the military-industrial complex, which we were warned against after World War I. If you look at the whole Smedley-Butler thing, if you don't know about Smedley-Butler, I highly recommend that you read. He's a general.
Smedley?
And
Butler?
Smedley, S-M-E-D-L-E-Y, Butler.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh.
Smedley Butler. He's an extraordinarily interesting person who literally stopped an armed coup in the United States, and most people don't know about this.
Interesting. But I guess the question here would be, so how do you stop that from happening? Because there was an interesting common critique I saw. You know, everyone, like,
well, sure,
the American first country to have a constitution, like the level of rights shredded in what was America originally,
yeah,
was never seen in the world. And it's what helped it become such a prosperous and big country. But there was an interesting comment that said, despite this, or because of this, in a way, it also created the most powerful, tyrannical empire the world has ever seen as well. It's like, I haven't thought about that way. Like, all this freedom ended up creating the most powerful government the world has ever seen as well. Yes. So I don't know. I don't know what to think about that.
That specifically is because of the erosion of the common Christian values of the United States, specifically. And then second, a majority of that happened after the erosion of the dollar in 1913 by the creation of the Federal Reserve and the IRS and the whole taxation thing. Mm-hmm. So if you undermine the moral cohesion of a group and also incentivize extraordinarily awful evil, vile behavior, which I believe having fiat currency that is currently, you know, constantly devalued, and it literally incentivizes evil.
Mm-hmm.
Of course you're going to have what we have now. Without the fiat devaluing of money, you cannot have the military-industrial complex that you have. You cannot have the growth of the federal government, which extracts value from everybody to the point it harms everything. You literally cannot have that kind of mind-bogglingly huge government and interference. You literally can't.
Okay.
Because hard money places hard limits on government, which is why those things were brought into place, so that certain people could profit from constant war.
I'm analyzing this in real time. So the way I'm seeing it and understanding is, okay, so this experiment was fantastic, how it began, but ended up, I guess you could say, quite bad. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. So I guess you could see this as version one of humans trying to become free, sovereign individuals again. I guess you could say it failed. But there could be a version two where you take what worked. And I think what the beginning of version one was useful, you know, when America was first founded. Sure. But there was, but now we have Bitcoin. Now we have decentralized communication like Nostr. I think we would try running this again, this experiment again, the American experiment, but with a new twist to avoid the things that set it all back, you know? So that's what I'm thinking about right now. But here's the next question. Do you think this version two or second try, whatever, happens in the geographical area of the United States of America, or will it go somewhere else? You know, like the Roman Empire collapsed and then like other empires came out around it. Rome didn't become big again, ever again. Do you think the American empire or its wealthness, its ideals more like, do you think its ideals move to another part of the world, or they'll re-flourish within the same area?
That's a complicated question. But the first thing that came to mind when you asked that is that you are ignoring the one factor that is constant no matter what system a person is placed in, is the fact that humans are part of the system. My contention is that unless you have a generally or like vast majority, like 90%+ Christian population, no system of government can last very long.
Not even in Kabistan, even though it's like...
No, not so. So if... Even the people that I consider principled atheist anarchists, it's hard, I think, for humans to exist in a spiritual vacuum, like you said earlier.
Yep.
I believe that humans were created to have a relationship with God. And without a direct relationship with God, you are going to fill it with things that are bad influences. Not necessarily that they are themselves bad, because science is good, except when it becomes its own religion.
Yeah.
You know, technology is good, except when it becomes its own mean to its own ends. You know, money is good, because it facilitates so much so easily, and it's easily one of the most influential things humans have ever come up with, except when it becomes a means to control everything and turn everything to crap. Like, without there being a relationship with God, in my opinion, I know that this is controversial and a lot of people disagree with this, but without having a personal relationship with God, And specifically, I mean the God of the Bible. I don't think that it is possible for human society to exist without devolving into the satanic pedo death cult, because it has every single time, with the rare exception of places that have been a majority Christian. And even then, as we're seeing, as people move away from that, look what has happened. Like the United States, from its foundation to roughly the late 1800s, was literally the freest place for the citizens of that country. I'm saying that specifically because there were a lot of atrocities that happened with the expansion of the United States that I don't think is correct. That's basically all I'm going to say about that subject, because it's really complicated and I don't know enough to talk intelligently about that. I can't change history, though. So I'm not going to get into the whole what should be done thing, because there are winners and losers in everything. And sometimes I think the losers are just being crybabies, but that's, again, a terrible opinion. I know that it's a terrible opinion, but it's still an opinion. But that period of time, the United States became the beacon of freedom and liberty to the entire world because of the cohesiveness of the vision of individual liberty, of being able to do literally anything as long as you basically worked hard or had an innovative idea that could change the world. Like, that's still what's being sold, even though that's not what you get in the package now. That was the peak. And then it went downhill, especially again after 1913. But there was a lot of things leading up to that between the end of the Civil War in the United States in 1865 and 1913. There were several groups of people that decided that they needed to control the progress because they wanted more of a piece of the pie. They thought they deserved more of a piece of the pie for controlling stuff than the people actually, like, doing the work, basically. And that's
right.
That's how we've ended up in this mess.
So I guess the conversation would then be like, what to do to avoid this in the future? Because I don't think you can change the current system. You can. You have to build a complete new one and build up from there. So I guess the question would be, what should this new system consist of? So from what I've taken from this conversation is, number one, God, you know, be the pillar. You combine that with hard money. It can be gold if you want, you know, but I think Bitcoin is the superior asset.
I'm very okay with there being different assets, because I don't think I disagree with the Bitcoin maxis. I don't think that Bitcoin in its current state can actually be useful all the time for everyone, for everything on the entire planet. I just don't think it can, especially like I know even less than Stella about the whole BIP 110 thing. And I don't have a dog in the fight because I don't run a node yet, you know, between Knots and Core. I don't know enough about that. But I don't understand why people are so dead set on Bitcoin being only one thing when there have literally always been at least two forms of currency in concurrent use throughout the history of everybody. There's always been a savings, gold, and silver. Or equivalents. There's always been like the common everyday spending currency and your savings. There's always been that on top of property, on top of goods.
To play devil's advocate, I guess you could say that could be like the savings is layer one and layer two could be the spending. It doesn't mean there has to be two different assets. It could be the same asset, but with the use of technology, it can serve that cause. You know what I mean?
I have yet to see lightning or anything else actually serve as something that you can literally spend as easily as gold and silver. I've not seen that. Think Bitcoin is absolutely 100% fantastic for what it is. Like I have probably the ironic thing is I've probably bought and sold more stuff. Or I bought more stuff with Bitcoin than most people on Nostr ever have with Bitcoin. Like outright, wait, I bought solar panels. Yeah,
yeah. Wait, so you've bought things with gold and silver?
I bought things with gold, silver, and Bitcoin, and I've done that probably more than most people on Nostr have.
Is it hard to buy things with gold and silver? Because I haven't tried, obviously, honestly.
If you know where, it's not hard. It that's the thing. Like, it's not popular anymore, but yes, you can. Or like, I have to, I can go to a pawn shop, sell off some junk silver, get cash, and buy stuff that way. I had to.
But let's say directly. What has been your experience? Have you been able to buy things with Bitcoin directly more than with gold and silver directly? Or vice versa?
Because I can order stuff online with Bitcoin. Last year, I bought solar panels with Bitcoin. I sent Bitcoin to a guy. He shipped me solar panels.
Okay, so but buying directly with gold and silver, that's been a lot less or somewhat similar, a bit less?
Well, I don't have as much gold and silver, so it's been less because of that. Like, I have more Bitcoin because it's easier to buy Bitcoin than it is to buy gold and silver for me because I've had to move and a whole bunch of other stuff. Like, I have sources to buy gold and silver right now if I want to, but it's easier for me to just buy Bitcoin through Strike or, however you want to. It's all KYC'd. I know that's an issue. I don't have time to deal with RoboSats or anything like that because it's just the premiums on that really eat into any progress I would make. So right now I'm just going, like, when I do buy Bitcoin, I just buy it as cheap as possible and I'll deal with the consequences of that later. Because quite frankly, I personally will never pay taxes on Bitcoin. I don't care. They can't get my Bitcoin.
I agree with that.
Plus, I don't have enough for them to really go after me yet. Mm-hmm. So, but like, even if I did, what, like, they can't get it. So screw them. I'm very adamant about that. But yeah, but like, the whole, like, I actually like Monero. I actually consider Bitcoin and Monero to be complementary technologies, just like gold and silver. Like, it's super easy to convert Bitcoin to Monero and back and forth. Super easy. But Monero gives you, it's more private by default.
How true is it that there is some risk of privacy loss when converting from Bitcoin to Monero and vice versa? Because I've heard that being an argument as well. And the anonymity set also being another argument.
There is risk, but like...
I don't know much about this, to be honest.
I know enough about it to be like, yes, there is some risk, but like there's risk doing anything these days. Anywhere, like if I wanted, like I said, if I wanted to sell my gold or silver, I have to go somewhere to do that. I have to meet someone to do that. I've got a cell phone in my pocket that is getting tracked. There's any, like if I go to a pawn shop, they've got 50 million security cameras in there. I am going to be surveilled somehow to do this unless I am operating completely off the grid, which I grew up before cell phones, but I don't really want to go back to that if I don't have to, even though I do think eventually I may have to because of the surveillance thing. But like, I think it's just like, I'm not worried so much about the risks because I accept them because when I do this kind of stuff, I'm just trying to build a network that is completely outside the fiat system. When I bought solar panels with Bitcoin. I did that. Like, I could literally have just paid with fiat, but I did that specifically because that, like, I was one of the first Bitcoin transactions that that seller conducted. And the more people that do that, the more familiar he is with that. He also, like, he also accepts a couple other cryptos. Like, good for him. Like, if someone wants to pay with whatever, he accepts it as a merchant. Good for him. Maybe he'll come to the conclusion that Bitcoin's the only one that he wants to accept in the future. Cool. I don't care. The fact is, he took my Bitcoin and I got solar panels. That's friggin' cool. Like, that's awesome. Anarchy
right there. No one forced you to pay with Bitcoin. And
yeah.
So,
I think that the more diverse the ecosystem is in money, the better.
Competition.
Just like everything else. Like, Bitcoin. Why? Exactly. Like, you have money is basically translating to time into value that you can trade easily. Like, that's why money exists. So you don't have to sit there and go through the whole, I want to trade apples for leather or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that's a pain in the butt. Exactly. Yeah. I am not biased against people using what they find to be a good way to do that. And that's, again, another thing that I hate about the government is because they're like, no, you shouldn't be able to do that unless we tax you to death on it. Like, screw you.
You is the only. Yeah, exactly. Oh, exactly.
No, thank you.
I guess to quickly sum this all up, because I have to go soon. But
sure.
To sum up bring it back to the Ancapistan type conversation. Oh, we originally was Bible and anarchy, right? But we'll continue that conversation when Stella's back. The anarchy thing. So we're saying, like, it looks like what we can do is God, Bitcoin, Nostr for decentralizing the media, because the information is also important for it to not be centralized. Yep. You mentioned the American Constitution, a set of rules or I guess the law, common law, that limits the government. I think that's a good thing to keep. Would you add anything else to something that could perhaps help create this more decentralized geographical area? It doesn't have to be a geographical area. I'm pretty sure you've heard of the network state by this guy's name, who I cannot pronounce. But and there's a lot of cool ideas out there. What I would say, though, is where would this... is just speculating and, like, just imagination for fun. You mentioned that it's important that it... Or it's perhaps essential that it's a Christian society for this Ancapistan to actually work, because of the values we already mentioned.
Yep.
So the check marks there would be, I guess... any of these Anglo-Saxon places? It could be Australia, Canada, England.
I specifically don't think that it could exist in an Anglo-Saxon area right now, because of how far those cultures have moved away from Christianity.
Question. How about pockets inside the United States? Like, every state in theory is its own country.
Yes.
So,
well, sure. Yes. Well, that's actually... So, I don't know if you're familiar with the Free State Project.
Yes.
If not, okay. So the Free State Project is trying to be a pocket of liberty by turning New Hampshire basically into as close to Ancapistan as they can get.
They're succeeding.
They are succeeding, much to the consternation of the statists in the state, who are losing power. Like, the Democrats and Republicans are teaming up against the Libertarians in New Hampshire to try to win elections, and that says something.
To me, that's interesting, because it's like, you know, the Roman Empire collapsed, well, the Western Roman Empire, but in that same, or close to Rome, you had things like the city-states of Venice, quite powerful and wealthy areas that were within the old empire. So that's how I can see perhaps this Ancapistan resurging in certain areas inside what is currently known as the United States of America. But I think another possible countries that could possibly tick the box, not necessarily, but possibly, Latin America. It's a lot of Catholics. Mexico is like the largest Christian, I mean, Catholic population in the world. But the big but here is our law comes from the Spanish Roman law.
Yes.
And I think that's different. A big hindrance to, you know, I think common law. So the way I would see it is perhaps an exodus of Americans or people with these values to these areas, building up communities, and then it just flourishing from there and making the local population perhaps adopt these ideals because they see, oh, they're becoming wealthy. Maybe if we do something similar, we'll become wealthy too. That, or they say they're wealthy, let's take their stuff, right? That's the other outcome.
Well, but, yes, but if you're wealthy enough to be moving into those areas and building small Ancapistans, then you're wealthy enough to be able to afford to pay people to protect you, generally.
True. Yeah. And
so that's the thing. Like, you're seeing pockets of that develop in various parts of South America. There are places that are being developed as economic enterprise zones, EZs, or something like that. There are places.
Like Honduras? Yeah. Like,
Yes. So there are places that see the potential for things like that. And that's good. But again, that's not happening in the United States, really, because of the centralization of power in our federal government. Although recent events are showing people that they don't want the federal government to do what they're doing. And as much as I don't agree with some of those, like what those people want to do, they're realizing that the federal government isn't the be-all and end-all of everything and that they should be doing more stuff on their own. And that's a good thing. But I don't know how it's going to play out because a lot of the people that are complaining at this point, because of the whole us versus them mentality, you know, our team's not in charge and I don't like the team that's in charge doing what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
They're probably just going to they're going to try to elect their team and then try to undo everything or swing the pendulum farther over to that side. But I do think a lot of people have realized that the government is not their friend. And why am I paying so much of my money, my income? Like, why is my, you know, why do I have to keep paying more taxes on everything? Why is my food cost going up, my healthcare going up so much? And more people are realizing it's just because of bad government.
Not enough, and, I would say.
No, true. But more than the preceding 20 years. And I think that's a big step in the right direction.
Yeah, I agree. So where do you think V2 of the American experiment will sprout or continue? Like, do you agree it could be somewhere in Latin America or some region of the United States?
Well,
Africa, Middle East, Asia?
No. Interestingly, I think that if Alberta, Canada manages to secede from Canada, that will actually be the center of a less government interference zone.
That'd be interesting.
Canadians are still too polite in a lot of ways, and I think that they wouldn't go far enough to be like an Ancapistan, but a lot of the leaders in Alberta right now realize that the Canadian federal government is not their friend. And under the Canadian Constitution, or however they're organized, they actually have the right to tell the Canadian federal government to go jump, because they actually have rights under that system, and they're starting to exercise them. Because Alberta has, like, they're starving to be able to export oil. Like, they have some of the best resources, not just in terms of like natural resources, they have some of the best human resources to be able to utilize the natural resources in a responsible way. Like, yes, a lot of people don't like fracking, and a lot of people don't like drilling, and a lot of people don't like whatever for some really dumb reasons. There are ways to utilize these things in a responsible manner that will help people all around the world. Like, for example, the whole war in Ukraine is literally causing a famine because Ukraine was the world, one, like the third largest exporter of nitrogen-based fertilizers. And because of the whole war, it's literally causing a famine. Like, hundreds of thousands of people are starving to death because of the war in Ukraine. And Alberta could actually fill in the gap, but the Canadian federal government doesn't want to let them do anything because, oh, it's bad for the environment or whatever.
You make good points there. And that brings up something else real quick. So the thing going on in Ukraine, I think a lot of people, myself included, think that it has all to do with the military industrial complex, obviously. Well, in my point of view. And I don't know if you've been, if you've heard of someone called Simon Dixon. I've been consuming his content. I bring him up all the time. I discovered him in the last 2 or 3 months. And
I don't know by name.
Simon Dixon. Okay, if you know who Efrat Fenningsen is, she has a podcast called.
Yes, I've heard that name.
Okay. She has a podcast called You're the Voice. She had a recent podcast with Simon Dixon. Definitely one of the best ones I think I've heard. You can hear that to catch up. But basically, the main thesis is the USA has agreed to shrink to a regional power because it's not that USA is the empire. It's transnational capital that's in charge. Something he calls the proof of weapons network, which is the financial industrial complex, the technical industrial complex, and the legacy military industrial complex. But the financial one is the one that currently sits on top because it's where they have the money, basically. So to sum it all up, there's USA shrinking to regional power, which is North America, Latin America, basically. China is basically going to take the other part of the world. You got the Middle East also having skin in the game. And he goes into more detail as to why. So, like, listen to his podcast. But it looks like the military-industrial complex is pulling out of the Middle East because the financial one is coming in. Basically, Gaza is now going to become the next big thing. Like, Trump says he's going to build Trump Towers. But anyways, financial-industrial complex is coming in. And the profits lost by the military-industrial complex, well, they got to regain them somewhere. So the focus will probably be Latin America or this part of the world. So the closer you are, because the military-industrial complex is more nationalistic. It's more USA-based, obviously. So this is the reason I'm mentioning this is because we're here talking about where the next possible Ankapistan could rise, you know, the V2 of the American experiment. And we're saying it's basically still on this side of the world, not anywhere else. But then again, you got this counter thesis that I've been hearing from Simon Dixon. It's like, oh, but I think it's going to be a lot harder because of what's happening around the world. But that's an interesting thing to talk about, I think, later on, if you decide to listen to Simon Dixon. Any thoughts on that?
If you'll send me a link to that podcast, I'll definitely listen to it for sure.
Oh, of course. I'll do that. Thanks. Anyways, Beav, this has been a great conversation. Nice.
Yeah, it has been.
We got to do V2 to get back into the Bible and anarchy conversation, which was the original subject. But do you want to, I think you work with the Git Citadel, right? That's your project.
Yes.
You want to promote that?
Yep. Sure. Yeah. So Git Citadel is building a lot of what I consider the best other stuff on Nostr. We recently reached a pretty big milestone with our Alexandria project, which literally is trying to build the best library and publication methodology on the planet in history. I know that sounds kind of nutty, but we're doing it. We're going to be shifting focus this year a bit. I'm not sure how much I can say about that yet, because we're still hashing out some things. But pretty soon we'll probably have another fairly big announcement with another project that is coming along. And we literally just want to take over the world with publishing and distributed documentation and archiving and research and anything to do with human knowledge. And it should be really interesting because big things are happening slowly because it, you know, we're, I'm not a coder. I test everything. I break a lot of things, which I'm good at. Yeah, it's just, it's a great group of people. You could check us out if you just at Git Citadel, GitCitadel on Nostr. You could check out the latest posts on stuff. We have a website, but that's all linked in the profile there. That's the easiest way to find us. If you're interested in contributing, we've got a Geyser Fund set up. And basically anything that's contributed is going to pay for servers that we run, and we're probably going to need to upgrade those for some of the projects coming. So anything that people feel like it's a worthwhile thing to donate would be appreciated. Goes right back into developing, like I said, some of the coolest other stuff on Nostr. And that's basically it. If you want to follow me on Nostr, I'm at the Beav. I post a lot or not, depending. And I usually, like I said, I have terrible opinions that are at least amusing at times. So check me out if you want something like that. Yeah, that's the best way to reach me. Or you can message me on my Simplex link, which is in my Nostr profile. And that's it.
Great. I'll add all those links in the show notes so everyone can follow them. And Aviv, again, thank you very much. Great conversation.
Thank you.
We'll see you for part two.
Yeah. Awesome.